You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine.
Welcome back to Sponsored. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and our guest on this week's program is Chris Benchetler. If you're not familiar with Chris's story, well, he's lived a roller coaster of a life. It started 45 minutes outside of Mammoth Mountain, California, in a town called Bishop, where he was born into an inseparable ski family who loved everything about the outdoors. Things started to change for Chris and his family when Chris's dad got cancer, and he eventually passed away when Chris was 16 years of age. This had a huge impact on Chris and still has an impact on Chris. And we're going to talk to him about how he was able to move forward in pursuing a ski career after that loss. We'll talk to him about getting his first sponsors, about making the change from park to pal. And we'll talk to him about the best career move he ever made when he left K2 and picked up Atomic. After that, it's all about Chris's art, his injuries, filming, crazy travel experiences, and who knows what else. Now it's time to talk to Chris.
Let me sing you a song. That's what I'll do. I was just trying to play the guitar. I'm not really going to sing you a song.
Oh, I was expected to be serenaded to start off the conversation. I figured that would be awesome.
No, I'm a bit scared to sing in public yet.
Do you know the dreidel song? That happens to be one of my favorites.
I do not.
Oh, well, it's made out of clay, and when it's dry and ready, oh, dreidel, you will play Chris Benchetler.
Awesome. So how are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I can't complain. You know, kid is alive. Wife is doing well. I can't complain at all. How about yourself?
Also can't complain. I'm happy and healthy. Do you have two children now or just one?
I have one that I know of, and I hope it stays that way.
Okay, fair enough.
And yourself? Are you going to have kids?
Not in the immediate future. Kimmy's crushing it a little too hard on her snowboard, so she's pretty... She's still psyched to keep riding.
Now, I hear that. I bet there would be a big market for a pregnant mom snowboarding video.
There probably would be, but if I was the father of that baby, I might be concerned. And I'm sure most mothers would be concerned, actually, too.
It creates the ability for you to create a new piece of equipment that protects the fetus in the womb while you're snowboarding, Chris, and you could make hundreds off of that.
Are we protecting it from like resort shredding or from Alaska shredding? Because I think there's probably plenty of pregnant moms that go ride the hill, but maybe if you want to like keep filming a video part, it might be a different story.
Yeah, I think you'd probably have to keep it to resort riding, and it probably wouldn't be an AK. And if it would, I mean, we'd have to come up with a new name for Tomahawk because it would be like a double Tomahawk. It would be like a kangaroo because she'd have something in her belly.
I like it.
Speaking of family, I know that's super important to you. And your family, your mom and dad were into the outdoors when you were a kid, right?
They were, yeah. They met up here in Mammoth in the 70s. And they both were very into, well, so my father was super into skiing. That's why he came up here.
Okay.
And I can't quite remember why my mom initially came here, probably for the skiing. And she was living with her cousin and four other women in a one-bedroom A-frame. And then she met my dad and kind of moved herself in without asking. So, yeah. And then he broke his leg super bad, and he... Also, he was a contractor, and so I think they had two like little A-frames in the quote-unquote ghetto. That's what Mammoth calls it for some reason.
Okay.
Down on Lupin Street, and one of his tenants burnt the house down, so my mom's dad came up and helped him rebuild it, and he became a contractor. And then they moved to Bishop and got super into horses, and so they rode like cutting horses for a while and competed doing that until they had children.
I don't even know what cutting horses are.
I don't entirely either, but they round up the cattle. He basically I think you have a rope, and I don't know if you rope the cattle or you just use the horses to like, they're super agile and they kind of get all the cattle into one area of the arena. And I don't know how entirely they got into it or what sparked that, but I think my mom used to ride horses as a kid, so she might have introduced my dad to it.
Can you throw a lasso? It seems like you are pretty good with like kendama and a bunch of other different things. Can you lasso?
I did learn when I was younger. I actually, when we got a trampoline, we used to make my dad rope us on the trampoline and see if he could lasso us. And he he showed me some tricks, but it's been like probably a couple decades since I've tried to lasso anything, so I don't know how my skills would be at this point.
I think you should buy one, and that should be what you do on your down days in Alaska, is just practice your lasso skills, and then it'll be a party trick anywhere you go, anytime.
That's pretty cool. I'm kind of like taking up guitar though, and that seems like a much more useful time consumer than learning how to lasso.
But why would you take up guitar? You're already married. It's not like you have to pull chicks. I mean, isn't that what the guitar's for?
I don't know entirely. I kind of think it's just a cool way to express another art form. But yes, I'm sure it pulls lots of females too.
Well, lassoing can pull lots of females as well. Like, I think you should really learn how to do that because it will be beneficial in the future.
I don't know. You just did say I was married, so there's no real point. But I could learn and then teach it to the younger generation so they could have good luck with the girls or something.
That's what I was going at because, yeah, I think the lasso is going to come back and I think you're the one that's going to bring it back.
Wow.
Yeah, but back to family. So you grew up 40 minutes from Mammoth and you'd go up there every day growing up or, you know, every weekend and whenever there was POW days?
Yeah, we were definitely weekend warrior program. And yeah, as I got older, I got into racing and my dad kind of made a lot of sacrifices to allow me to do that because at that time there wasn't really anyone outside of Mammoth that was on the race team. And we didn't have a ton of money or ability. Like, race teams are rather expensive, so
yeah.
I kind of had a lot of hand-me-down skis and clothes from my cousin who lived up here and was on the race team. And then my dad was a volunteer host, which is like, I'm sure multiple mountains call them hosts, but they're not quite ski patrol. They just kind of help people who are lost find their way on the mountain. So he would do that so he could get a pass, and he would bring me up on the weekends and then for me to ski, because those were the days that Dave McCoy only cost kids $3 for a lift ticket. So that was pretty cool.
Nice.
And yeah, so come up on the weekends, then I finally was able to join the race team and started doing that.
How were you as a racer?
I never thought I was too impressive. I mean, I didn't win any races that I can remember, but I mean, I think I was all right. I made Junior Olympics once or twice, which is I forget what your results had to be, but you had to do decent to make the Junior Olympic team. So
I would hope you had to do decent to make the Junior Olympic team.
Yeah. yeah, but I never won anything. I think I was a little bit more interested in riding the mountain, and kind of the park was definitely blowing up at that time, so it was very hard to stay focused on wearing a downhill suit and racing when my brother and all of my snowboarder friends were kind of having the time of their lives in the park.
So when did you turn in the Lycra?
When did I turn in the Lycra? How old was I? I think 14, maybe 15.
Wow, so you raced for a while.
Well, kind of. I started late. Like I said, I was my dad would bring me up on the weekends, and then I guess I'm sure multiple mountains had this too, but we used to have a thing called the pay course, and it was like a dual GS, and I think you paid $1 or $2 to race your friend.
NASTAR.
Yeah, I did one of those, and apparently one of the coaches saw me racing and then approached my dad and said, hey, you should sign him up for the race team. And so that would have been, I only did second year J4 and then, or sorry, 2 years of J4 and 1 year of J3. So I raced for 3 years.
Okay, so yeah, not that long.
Yeah, not that long. And then, yeah, I turned in the Lycra kind of when I realized that racing, I had to choose one or the other, essentially. It was either train all the time and get really into racing and stop ditching practice for the park, or ditch completely. So I was able to convince my parents to let me step away.
So it's kind of either be fast or have fun?
I guess so. Yeah, it was hard to see or go and train gates when it was like a powder day or any other day where you'd rather be riding the mountain.
So at that point, you're 14, you kind of make the switch from being a racer, and the park's blowing up at that point. They're allowing skiers in the park, which I'm sure is a big deal for you because you grew up riding with snowboarders or skiing with snowboarders. And at one point, were they allowed in the park and you weren't, or were you past that?
I was just young enough that I didn't really ever have to deal with that, fortunately. And I think Mammoth was actually on the cutting edge of that too. They allowed skiers pretty early on, and though my brother was a snowboarder and his best friend was John Jackson at the time, so I followed them a lot. But also Rory Silva lived here, and I used to be quite good friends with Rory. Well, I would still consider myself good friends with Rory. I just don't see him much. But he was on the cutting edge for skiing. He was like the first person I saw ski backwards or anything. And then around that same time is when Pep and Tanner and all those guys moved to Mammoth because the park was pretty phenomenal. So everyone made their way out here. So it was just good timing for me, basically, age-wise.
Rory has come up in every interview that I've done so far, except for Wayne Wong. He didn't know of Rory.
Really?
Everybody I've talked to has a great Rory story, and I wonder if you have a great Rory story.
There's many great Rory stories.
I want the best.
The best. Holy cow, this is a lot of pressure. No, I think I can't think of a specific story. I can think of like a simple one. He has a very bad diet for being a diabetic. Right. And he used to stay the night when we still lived in Bishop. He used to come down and skateboard with us and stay the night. And my mom's quite an impressive cook. And I remember Rory used to ask for just a cheese quesadilla instead of whatever we were having for dinner. And then when my mom would do the sheets of when she'd wash the sheets, she would find like Cheeto and chip bags in the bed and stuff. So I don't think his diet or her lifestyle, health-wise, was quite the best for his predicament. But, yeah, he has a heart of gold. He's a good kid.
Yeah, he's an awesome kid. And you're right, his diet isn't the greatest. And his health choices compared to yours, who you might be one of the healthier people I know. You do live a super healthy lifestyle and are really active.
I am incredibly active. And, yes, I kind of look at my body. I mean, I've been hurt enough that I understand too. I probably wasn't the healthiest early on in my life. I was a bit of a picky eater, but once I broke enough bones and kind of realized what it takes to come back from an injury, that what you fuel your body with is the most important thing. And can kind of look at it like your snowmobile. You're never going to put cheap gas in your snowmobile because you want it to run optimum or anything for that matter. Yeah, you just try to put the best fuel possible in your body so you can last out there all day and do everything that you want to do. And in my case, I like to do things from sun up to sundown, so it's nice to have the energy to do that.
And when you use that great fuel, have you found that it reduces your injuries, or it just gives you more energy and makes you feel better?
I'd say it gives you more energy and makes you feel better. But I mean, at the same time, I've been pretty fortunate with injuries. I still get hurt. But I think injuries, those type of injuries, just come from pushing it. You know, some people don't have it. I guess you have to just have like a... what's the word I'm looking for? You have to be rational at times, and you can't just always send it. You have to like take into conditions into account and so on and so forth, and just be a bit calculated. And not everyone that is a professional athlete has that filter. They just kind of go 100% all the time. And I think that is more contributing to injuries than what you're eating. But I definitely think eating healthy and living healthy helps tremendously with recovery and just everything in life, really.
Are you gluten-free?
Not entirely. I kind of think life needs moderation. I avoid gluten, but I avoid a lot of things for a lot of reasons. I don't have any issue with gluten, like on a health level. I just don't think my body agrees with it all that much. Like I don't get a ton of energy or feel that great when I eat it. But like I said, life needs moderation. So if I'm traveling in Italy and all you can eat is pizza and pasta, I'm definitely going to eat pizza and pasta. So I think you can't be too hung up on diets and those type of things, or you're just going to make yourself miserable. And probably the most important factor in being happy and healthy is mental health. So if you're going to be stressed out all the time on what you're eating and can't have this, can't have that, you're probably going to be more unhealthy than if you were just to eat it in the situations where you have to and then try and be good when you can be good.
Okay. I thought you were going to say that you're gluten-free and you're going to be like a gluten-free type of Nazi, and I was going to end the conversation right there because I love gluten. I think it's great for
you. It's tasty for sure. I just, I don't know. When I eat a pizza or whatever, I don't feel that awesome after, but it tastes good going down.
Well, you should come get pizza with me. You will feel amazing afterwards. Every pizza I eat is really good. But That's not important right now. What is your life and your career, and we stopped at about 14. You had moved from racing to the park. I know at that time in your life, too, I mean, your family was super tight and family was really important to you, and your dad got sick at 14, and I know that that had to play a huge role in shaping who you are today, and I'm sure it still impacts a lot of the decisions you make, but going through a huge loss like that, diagnosed at 14 and might have passed a couple years later, how was that as, you know, an impressionable young kid? How did that affect
you? Oh, man, it affected me in a lot of ways. I don't know how in-depth you'd like me to get, but I'd say first and foremost, I had a hard time being at 14 and just like understanding the severity of cancer and the potential of actually losing my dad. Because when he was there, he was obviously insanely sick, but I just don't think you... At an impressionable teenager, you can't quite fathom. Oh, sorry, someone's at the door.
It's okay.
My dog's gonna bark. You can't quite fathom like what that really means in the big picture. So I was pretty jealous. My brother and my dad were butting heads at that point because he wanted to be a snowboarder, but he's incredibly intelligent. So he moved up to Mammoth. They had a lot of arguments, but he started doing this thing called charter school where you don't have to actually be in school. You get to go once a week. But anyways, so he convinced my parents to let him do that. He moved up to Mammoth, and he was living in with Matt Hammer and just snowboarding every day. And so I was obviously very jealous of that, having to go to school every day. And then on top of that, my dad was getting sicker and sicker pretty quick. So he wasn't able to drive after a while. So I started having to drive illegally to drive him to work every day. And then he has a crazy story, but he was from Hungary. So he would like, and he never taught us Hungarian because they escaped during the revolution. So that's a whole nother story. But anyways, he would be like in crazy pain and scared and sick and start talking to me in Hungarian, and there was just a lot to deal with that I didn't quite know how. And then my mother and him would fight quite a bit, like verbally, because he was obviously scared of dying and scared that she wasn't going to be able to take care of us financially because he was kind of the main moneymaker for the house. So
yeah,
there was just a lot to deal with. I was kind of like had to grow up very quick. I was a mediator between my parents. I'd have to drive him to the hospital in the middle of the night. I'd have to take him to work. I'd watch him sleep in the back of the car with his eyes open, just on a ton of morphine and Oxycontin, basically, to try and deal with his pain levels. And I'd be like scared to wake him up every day. So I dealt with a lot. I could go pretty deep. That was two years of that. And at the whole time, I was just didn't understand like why my brother got to snowboard every day and miss all of that. But now I'm pretty grateful that I got to spend so much time with my dad, obviously, since he's no longer here. And it was a wild experience.
Yeah, I mean, that makes you the man of the house, like at a young age.
I guess so. It was it was an odd thing to deal with for sure. But at the same time, he was very supportive of my skiing and would still allow me to miss school for certain competitions. Because at that point, I think, when did I meet? I'm trying to think when I got sponsored by K2. I was probably 15. And so he was still around and still sick. And I did a couple U.S. Opens while he was still around. But he was never able to make it out to him. Just my mom would come out. And so he was still obviously letting me chase my dream. I just had a lot more responsibility than most 14, 15-year-olds.
Yeah, I mean, at 14, 15, you're worried about if you ski, you're worried about going skiing, you're worried about watching TV. The last thing you need to deal with is what you had to deal with. And at that same time, it's like when you go, you know, you're handling the issues at hand at home. You're taking your dad to the hospital. You're doing a bunch of things. I mean, are there times where you just go in your room, you just put your hands over your face and you just don't know what to do with yourself as you're so upset? Or do you just grab life by the horns and say, we're going to make the best out of this?
I kind of made the best out of it. I'm someone that wears my emotions on my sleeve, so I'm not too introverted, and I don't, like, I obviously cry and things, and I would express my feelings, but I wouldn't dwell on those things. I would just kind of deal with them as they came. And I didn't know it at the time, but now something I try to practice is being very present in my life and live life in the moment, because it's obviously short. But I think I was fortunate that I kind of always lived that way. So I would just deal with each day as it came and learn from it. And even if I didn't understand what I was learning at the time, it definitely, like you said, shaped me into who I am today. So I'm quite thankful for it now. And I think it gave me a totally different appreciation for skiing. And skiing was probably a bit of a release for me, because I got to just get up here and be with my friends and focus on the task at hand and not really thinking about all the hard stuff at home.
Yeah, when you get on the hill, you get your goggles on, everything kind of, life fades behind you and all you can focus on in the mountain. It's a nice little escape.
Yep, for sure.
So you mentioned at that point you're 15, and that's when you kind of get connected with K2. I know Pep was a big influence in getting you on K2. How did that all go down?
Pep was just like blowing up at that point, or I should say majorly blowing up at that point. I think when I was 16 is probably when 1242 came out. But he met me through Rory. I just skied with him once or twice, and then we had a U.S. Open, or what did they used to do? Some type of qualifier. Maybe it was I forget what the competition was. I don't think it was quite the Open, but some kind of qualifier, maybe to get you to the Open.
Okay.
It was in Tahoe, and I won my heat going into finals, and Goot was there, and Pep and Rory were riding for K2 at that point. And so Pep just kind of handed me over to Goot and said that Mike should sponsor me. It's from what I remember. I mean, that could be totally different in Mike's eyes, but it was essentially that. He had just been watching me ski in Mammoth, and we'd met, and I think I did decent at a competition, and it was kind of just escalated from there.
That's exactly what he had to say about it. And you're on K2 for a couple years. I know you had a Parkasaurus shoot probably a year into your K2 time. And, you know, that was a big shoot for you. I think you got MVP from the shoot, but you also walked away with a terrible injury. And Mike said it was one of the worst ones he's ever seen on the snow, just your reaction to the injury and the pain that you were in. What happened at Parkasaurus?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I walked away from Parkasaurus.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No. Yeah, I was... That was awesome, because Parkasaurus was at June Mountain, and at that time it had an insane park, and it felt like home. I was at home, essentially. I was 15 minutes away from home, so I felt very comfortable, and I knew the jumps well, so I was guinea-pigging a lot of the jumps, and the main feature there was this big 100-and-some-odd-foot jump with a hip built into it, too, and no one had hit the jump yet.
Okay.
So I guineed it and got a couple tricks on it, and then kind of the photographers, when that happens, when they see something materializing like that, they kind of make their way over to the feature. So that started to happen, and then everyone was like, oh yeah, let's wait till sunset for better light. So I didn't have any issue with that, and so being a naive 17-year-old, I didn't re-speed check or anything. I just kind of like kept going with the session an hour later, but the entire in run had been shaded at that point.
Yeah.
And I decided I was going to hit the jump switch, which I hadn't done yet. And so I went way too fast and ended up overshooting the jump by a solid 40 or 50 feet and drifting over to it was right against tree line. So there was kind of like an ice curb from the snowcat with just some chunder balls over on the right. And I drifted over to those and hit one with my femur, and I ended up cracking my femur and then partially tearing my ACL. And I think that was it. Yeah, that was it. And then, yeah, I kind of blacked out and don't entirely remember the impact or anything, but I felt like my knee, it was slightly bent, but I felt like if I tried to bend or straighten it, that it wanted to kind of explode. It felt like if I did anything, that everything inside was just kind of explode. So that was unfortunate. And yeah, they put me on a backboard. Then I had to go down the mountain, June Mountain. I don't know if you've been there, but they have a very slow chairlift. So I had to ride by myself down like a 15-minute chair ride on the backboard before I could get pain meds. And then at that point, I was still in the money-saving mentality and portion of my life, and I didn't realize that insurance probably would have covered this, but I was like, I can't take an ambulance, that's way too expensive. So I had just started dating Kimmy a few months before that, so she was actually there, and she drove me to the ER in Mammoth, and then so on and so forth. So once I finally got morphine or whatever they gave me, it was mellowed out. But for the first hour plus, it was a pretty painful experience.
Sounds miserable.
Yep.
But that's part of the game, being a professional skier, and you recover from that. And I know there's a ton of hard work that goes into the recovery. And you know what? I don't want to hear about any hard work in recovery, because we just want to talk about the skiing, to tell you the truth. You know, at that point in your career, you know, you've recovered from the injury and you're on K2 and it comes up to be, you know, a contract year for you. I'm in the role of team manager at that point, and it's kind of, hey, you know, let's see what's out there, Chris, because at this point we have Seth Morrison, Andy Mayer, Pep Fuhas, Sean Pettit, and yourself all doing similar types of skiing. You know, not everybody's the same by any means. Everybody has their unique style and what they like to do. But at that time, it was, we're going to have to make a tough decision at some point. And we thought we were going to have to let somebody go. But then you came back and you called me and you said, Atomic has given me an offer. And I asked you, I'm like, do you mind sharing the dollars? And you did share the dollars. I was, hey, I'm not going to insult you with an offer, because what they're offering you is something that I'm not going to come close to. And it sounds like a great move for your career moving forward. And tell me about your experience with Atomic and what they've allowed you to be able to do, because they've really taken your career and helped you elevate it to another level completely.
Yeah, absolutely. And at that point, it was actually a couple years after I injured myself when I left. It was in, trying to think, because I had just had one of my better years. I think I had closing segment with Poor Boys. I was in Idea.
That was like 2007, I think.
Yeah, and I had a Warren Miller segment, and then I had my first cover with Powder all that year. So I think that contributed to Atomic approaching me.
For sure.
And yeah, so that was like one of the better years I'd had since I'd been back from my injury. And they were just, they didn't have an image that I necessarily agreed with or wanted to be a part of at that point in time. But, and K2 obviously did, and K2 felt like family. I had obviously kind of built a relationship with you guys. So I think, yeah, it was a hard decision, but I just kind of pitched the idea of me building a ski with Atomic. Cause like you said, Seth and Pep and Sean hadn't had a ski at that point, or I guess he had the Juvie, but he was about to have everything at his fingertips. So
yep.
It made sense for me to kind of step away, so I wasn't being compared, well, not even compared, but just standing side by side to all these greats. And Atomic didn't really have a backcountry team at that point, so I pitched the idea of creating my own ski, and then they bit the bait, and you guys, like you said, it wasn't an option for K2, so I kind of went that route, and I was fortunate enough that I was able to. It was at the time when Rocker was just being presented. I think I had some prototypes from K2 that were before. I didn't even ever get to ski on the Hellbent, actually, so they were before the Hellbent, but I knew that Rocker was coming and that I wanted that in my skiing, so I was able to just kind of like take different aspects of things I knew I wanted and create a good ski. And then that did well, and Atomic was happy and led into more opportunity and a bigger relationship down the road, I guess.
It's amazing. The image before you got to Atomic, from what I remember, I think it was Rex Thomas might have been the team manager, and they were selling triplets, I believe.
Yeah, exactly. And I kind of, that's a bit different than my image for sure. And so Jordan Judd was the one who called me, and he had just come on board with Atomic, and he had, luckily I was good friends with Pollard at that point, and he had worked with Pollard over at Line. So Eric kind of reassured me that Jordan had a clue and knew what he was doing. And I think he really helped Atomic come out of the trenches. And by virtue of that, I was able to have a lot of insight and have someone over here in the States that wasn't in Austria that kind of understood what I wanted and what I wanted to do. So together we were able to help Atomic kind of completely change their image and turn into an incredible company, because now I'd say they're kind of one of the top in the game with their athletes and their skis and image and everything. So
I agree with you completely. They've done a total 180 from the triplets. And for people that don't know, at one point you could buy a pair of park skis from Atomic and they'd give you a third ski just in case one of your skis broke. And I never got that. It was like saying, hey, our skis might not be that durable, even though they were, because when you throw another ski in there, it's just like, well, are one of these going to break?
Yeah, it was an odd campaign, but I'm happy they stepped away and they've come out on top.
Yeah, and they're doing some great things with all their products, and it's a tribute to them listening to athletes. And one thing, you know, that's amazing with your pro model is not only you skiing on it, but you've got some other legendary skiers skiing on it, and then the launch that Atomic does. Who's the mastermind of how they're launching these products there?
Well, I mean, it's changed over the years. I've had a number of different marketing managers at this point, but I think because of the success of my ski, just by virtue of how well it skied, was played a role to it, because that was the reason Sage and all these awesome skiers would ski on it, Durgy and those guys, is just that it performed a lot better than some of the other powder skis out there, and then definitely some of other Atomic's other skis. So it just worked. The timing was right. It was kind of like when I was back in the day on K2, I feel like every single one of us used to ski on Pep's pro model in the park. It was just a superior ski that we all wanted to be on. So that helped me tremendously, like you said. And then the marketing behind my ski was just, I think it was just a product of the time. A lot of people were skiing on it. There was a lot of good photos around it. There was a lot of people doing good things, like Durgy. One of the earlier years of my skis had an insane part, landing backwards pretty much the entire time, and I just had a lot of people doing great things on my skis. So the marketing kind of fell hand in hand with that.
And the art on the skis is all done by you, and every rendition has looked great. So you're doing a great job on designing the skis. They save a little graphic design money by having you do the art, but that helps you in the long run as well.
Yep.
But, you know, and speaking of the marketing, one thing I've noticed over your career is you're really good at marketing yourself. You're really good at getting sponsors, and you're one of the hardest workers out there. And when I look at your website, and you can go to chrisbenchetler.com and look at his website, but the amount of sponsors that Chris has, I mean, he's Atomic, GoPro, Dakine, Dragon, Mammoth, BCA, Sonic, Cliff, Evo, Windsox, Evol. There's so many sponsors there. Most athletes don't have that many in the ski industry, and that's really how you're able to not only make a living, but not have to think about your next meal. And I think you have two houses, and you're in a van conversion right now. So you have some money to play with being a professional skier, is that right?
Yeah, to an extent. I think I'm in a very fortunate situation where my wife is also a pretty badass athlete. So most athletes are kind of fending for themselves, like these people like Pep or Sean, or who have houses and cars and things too, but that's all coming out of their pocket. So I wouldn't say that I'm totally killing it by any means, but I'm comfortable, and I'm a very hard worker, like you said. And I think the biggest thing that's been a success for me is just being forward thinking and thinking outside of the box. And with this van conversion, for instance, I've had a dream for a few years, and I was just able to build a pitch deck around it and convince my sponsors and GoPro that I could create an awesome series for them by doing it. So I just have tried to find ways where I can kind of mix work with play and utilize, like, a van is something I've always wanted in my life. I shouldn't say always, but I've wanted one for a few years now. So I've been kind of brewing, like, how can I get a van and make it a work vehicle and create something around it? So that's where I came up with this new idea. So yeah, to answer your question, I would say I don't necessarily have money to play with, but I've just been smart with my investments, and I have a wife that's doing well in the industry as well. So we can both use our minds and use our sponsors to kind of propel us further and try and set ourselves up.
So I read into that as I trick people into giving me the money to make the van so I can create content for them. So it's not really tricking people, but you're looking to your sponsors to help you in chasing your passion, and in turn creating content for them that's going to help build their brands.
Yeah, which I wouldn't call tricking at all.
No tricking, I know.
We're both benefiting from it tremendously, and just the timing and how you think of these things. You know, van conversions are insanely trendy at the moment.
Yep.
I found a Finnish carpenter that was also into helping me out, so I'm saving money there. And this is going to be a series that will include him and based around him and create business opportunity for him. And then I'm going to be painting art on the van, or doing a mural for the van, I should say. I'm not actually painting it on the van. And so I've included a muralist that's a friend. And I think all of that stuff is just by being proactive and having friends in all these different sports and areas that you can kind of help each other out. And that seems to be life in any job or anything. It's a lot of who you know and the opportunities you can create for yourself. And I think success comes from, you basically, you don't get what you don't ask for. So if you just put yourself out there and ask and try and make things happen, a lot of times you'll surprise yourself.
Yeah, and I think, you know, another thing to success goes back to your work ethic too. You can have the greatest idea ever, but if you're lazy, you're never going to make it happen. And if you have an idea and you know your work ethic, you know you're going to put 110% into everything that you do, you're always going to be successful. And if you aren't, you know you put everything you had into it and there's no regrets.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I mean, that's a great example. I'm at the point with this van project where I actually haven't signed contracts or anything, so I'm having to make a lot of decisions and front a lot of money just with faith that my sponsors are going to pull through and that everyone's into it. But that's something where you just make the initial investment and hopefully it comes back.
Yeah. And you know, something unique about your sponsors that I found out as well is, I mean, I look at the list of your sponsors and went onto your LinkedIn and you've been with almost every brand for at least, I think GoPro was the shortest at like 4 years. But I mean, there's 14 years, 9 years, 8 years. Loyalty's really paid off for you in the long run, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am very true to what I believe in, like, and what the brands stand for. And I've tried to align myself with brands that kind of have a similar vision. And I think I've done pretty decently there.
Yeah, you've done really well there. I think everything lines up with who you are and what you do. We're going to get to a couple more questions. One, there's a pretty interesting story that I want you to tell. We talked about your wife, Kimmy, earlier. She's arguably a better athlete than yourself. I won't say that.
You could say it. She is. It's true.
There was a unique proposal story, and I don't know if people have heard it, but I did, and I'd like you to share how you proposed to your wife.
Okay. That was, she had just had like a meniscus surgery or something pretty minor, but we used to, or she trail runs a lot and we used to go to this lake together a lot. I was just going to Chile. So I convinced her, I was like, hey, you're getting better. I need to practice with my beacon. We should go up to a lake and just do a little fake scenario because it's the middle of summer. And I'll bring a backpack and some snacks because, you know, you haven't been hiking or anything, so that should be mellow. And so she was like, yeah, sounds like a great idea. So I went, got a dozen roses, got our beacons, got the ring, and I put them all in the backpack because we would never normally run or hike with a backpack. So okay. that was task number one that I completed. So I was able to sneak all that stuff in. And then we went up to the lake, and then I convinced her, I was like, here, how about you go first? You haven't practiced in a while either. And I don't know, since I'm the one that's supposed to be practicing, it's funny that she was willing to go first.
Right.
I set the beacon, or I made her go hide in the trees up on a hill, set the beacon up and put the roses around it in the shape of a heart on the beach, and then put the ring on top of the beacon and ran back up the hill. And I was like, all right, go for it. And so she started the search and was staring at her numbers. I don't know how many people, I'm sure most of the people listening to a Powder podcast have used a beacon, but yep. Anyways, so she was pretty focused on her beacon and the numbers and not really looking in front of her. So by the time she got to the beacon, she, dropped hers and was just kind of like crouched down staring at the ring and kept saying, oh my God. And I was behind her on one knee and asked her to marry me.
That is so romantic.
Thank you.
It's amazing. My wife is going to hear this and be like, why didn't you do anything like that for me? That's a different story for another time. And I'm going to go with one more question, although we'll probably get three questions out of this. Tell me about your craziest travel experiences that you've had over the past, you know, decade.
Whew. The one unfortunate thing with me, Mike, is my memory is awful.
But you don't even smoke weed, right?
I don't. I've just hit my head a lot. I just had another bad concussion on a mountain bike this summer, and it was right after I saw that movie Concussion. So I got all freaked out and actually went and saw a neurologist for my first time. And
wow.
Which confirmed that my memory is not doing so great. But anyways, that's neither here nor there. But I'm trying to, so just off the top of my head, I'm not really great. I need things to jar my memory. I've traveled to so many incredible places and had so many incredible experiences. I'm trying to think. You want...
Not really crazy. I want to hear like a comedy of errors. They lost my bags. The cabbie took my wallet.
Oh, jeez.
I wasn't able to check in the hotel. Do you have one like that?
I have all of those things have happened to me at some point. But I mean, I feel like that's just part of traveling. So
yep.
It doesn't hold like a special place in my heart, or I don't dwell on it because it just always kind of tends to happen. But let's see here. We... First time to Japan with Tyler and Pep, that was very foreign to me. And we're in Tokyo. We have all our stuff. We don't really know where we're going or what we're doing. We're actually supposed to – I was on K2 still at that point. We were supposed to meet a Japanese distributor somewhere. And so we
Tanaka.
we were just jump on the train, and Pep busts out a map and starts – essentially reading and speaking Japanese, because apparently he took it in seventh grade and he wasn't by any means fluent in it, but he was able to get us to where we needed to go and what we needed to do. That was impressive. I remember being, and that whole trip in general, I mean, that was the first time we ate raw horse, we ate fish guts. Pep and Tyler ended up eating raw chicken after I left. That whole trip was quite an eye opener, and that kind of sparked my love for Japan, and I've been back 8 times since, I think. And what else? I mean, every trip I had done with JP Eau Claire had incredible stories and first time experiences for me. My first time to Alaska was super heavy. Anthony Bornowski got buried in the avalanche up to his neck. I had never really been in those kind of mountains, and the Abbey danger was crazy high. I know that's not really traveling. That's more ski related. Shoot.
I mean, it sounds like you just don't have anything off the top of your head.
Yeah.
And that's quite all right. I mean, I was just wondering if you had that,
nope.
Oh, this one time, you know, we were on this boat, but a whale hit it, and you know, but you don't have any of that. So where do you see yourself in 20 years?
That's a great question. I mean, I honestly see myself still involved in the industry, never at a desk job, because I would not be able to sit inside. And I know that very well about myself. And I don't need a lot to be happy other than climbing, surfing, and skiing. So wherever that takes me, I've contemplated going down the guiding route later in life. I've contemplated a number of different things. I think business opportunities will present themselves. And like I said earlier, if I just continue to be forward thinking and think outside the box, I think I can create opportunities for myself. But I just try and live life in the moment and kind of stay healthy and stay present. And I don't really know where I'll be in 20 years. I might not even be here. So I'm not too concerned what's going to happen. I just want to keep living this lifestyle.
Well, it's a refreshing outlook on life that you have, and I want to thank you for coming on. And I'm going to have you back again if you're willing to be on, and I'll take that as a yes.
Yeah, no problem.
Perfect, man. Well, Chris, I want to thank you. You have a great rest of your day, and I will talk to you soon, man.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Take care.
Always refreshing to talk to Chris Benchetler, and we've got more Chris Benchetler over on the PowelMovement.com. He's going to answer some inappropriate questions from Colby West. He will also come up with 3 inappropriate questions for our guest next week, Michelle Parker. And Michelle, like Chris, is a true professional, and it'll be great to catch up with her, our first female on the show. If you have any questions for Michelle, you can reach me at PowelMovement1 on Twitter, or shoot me an email, Mike@thePowelMovement.com. Once again, I want to thank you for listening to the sponsored podcast on Powder Radio. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and we'll talk to you next week with our guest, Michelle Parker. Thanks a lot.